Thank you, Professor Pregadillo. Wow, my voice is echoing. It's like I'm in a large hall. I want to, first of all, express my gratitude to the staff and everyone here. I've had an incredible, this is an incredible place. I must say that in all my years of scholarship, I can only think of one other time when I've been around such a stimulating group of people. And I want to thank Professor Lochner for bringing everyone together and making this possible. It's been an amazing 3 months. I've learned a lot. And I don't want you to judge me by what I have to say here today, because I think I'm still in the process of learning. And I've learned a lot from all of you, and I hope that you don't feel that I'm distorting your ideas. What I intend to do today is to reflect a little bit on my journey of the last 3 months, and to give you some sort of idea of how the material I work on fits into the larger project here, and then to hear what you have to say. So I'll try to be as brief as possible. First, I just wanted to say thank you to all of you, and Professor Lochner in particular, for making this such a great place to be. The only other time in my scholarly career, I said there was one other time that I've been this stimulated, and that's when I first began my work back in Berkeley. So this has been an incredible and memorable experience. What I want to talk to you today about is, I call mantic echoes. I originally had thought that I would look through the Lingbao scriptures, which Professor Pagadillo just mentioned, having to do with Taoist ritual, and see how Taoist ritual had, even though Taoism early on put divination to one side and said they, and for reasons I'll talk about in just a minute, put divination to one side and said, we don't want to practice divination even though the rest of the society does. They still had to pick days for ritual practice, they had to pick sites for ritual practice, they had to bury people, all of these things in the larger Chinese society involving divination. So originally I thought that I would just do, I would just look through the Lingbao scriptures and talk about those ritual moments. But I soon, when I got here and began talking to people, I started to reflect upon the larger kind of development of Taoism and realized that I had something which was for me much more valuable, and that is stories. I'm at base a literature person, and as well as a philologist, and so I love very much stories. And I wanted to talk about some of the ways in which those Taoists who didn't necessarily practice divination still included divination in their practice. It sounds paradoxical, but I hope by the end you'll see what I mean. And I'm hoping to make this available to those of you who don't. Some of these texts I've talked about before when we had the meeting of sinologists earlier this summer. I'm hoping to make this available for everyone who does European and other sorts of subjects as well. So I'll be as clear as I possibly can and use as few Chinese words as I possibly can. My students always say, you know, we really love Chinese literature, but there are too many Chinese names. So, yeah, we can call him Ronnie and George. All right, so what I plan to do then, my outline. First of all, I'd like to establish the fact that we tend to think of divination and prophecy as two separate things. And what I'm going to talk about is the result of a prophet. So we tend to divide them up a little bit and make some sort of bipartite distinction, and I'd like to look a little more closely at that bipartite distinction. So as I walk around the halls here, I hear a lot about divinatory technique, what sort of practices, what sort of dice do they use, what sort of bones do they crack. So technique as opposed to what? Well, we'll talk a little bit more about it, but something psycho-spiritual anyway. Prophecy is not associated generally with materials. It's a single medium. Then, after having talked a bit about that, I want to think about what might have been important to the consumers, and this grows out of my Chinese studies in my Chinese text, and that is interpretation. I would call it hermeneutics because there are a particular academic style of interpretation which is used for divination, which is also used for prophecy. And I think that tells us something about how this was consumed in Chinese society. Third, I'm going to give some 4th century CE examples of Taoists, I call it, who dreamt of divination because they're not practicing it. They're channeling people who did, as you'll see. So this is prophetic visions of divination. That also will sound weird to you until I give you the examples. These will be personal predictions, things having to do with grave construction, siting of graves, and building of graves. Again, usually a matter for diviners in China, and dream interpretation. So we began with the bipartite division. Professor Malzinger had us read this, and so it was my first encounter. I make bold to admit. This division of that Cicero gives of the Stoics into the artificial and the natural is, I want to say, and you know this, you all know this passage better than I do, so there's no need to linger on it too much. But what I want to point out here is that this bipartite division of divination through various practices, mantic practices, and divination through a medium without any kind of material support continues, but the valuation of it tends to be turned upside down. If you read this carefully, it seems like the natural is privileged a bit over the artificial. The artificial, of course, being the relies upon premonitory signs, on augurs, methods. And what I want to point out is that in the modern age, we tend to kind of turn this valuation over, while the natural is something that comes from God. I'll give you a few examples of what I mean. This is from the Encyclopedia of Religion, the article on prophecy and overview by Shepherd and Herbertsmeyer. Access to the world of the gods came through two different means, they argue. Techniques used to interpret symbolic messages, both manipulative and more purely observational. So again, the same sort of division we see in Cicero. And gods were also believed. I think it's that word also that I think kind of set me off a little bit. This is some added technique that they communicate their will through oracles, that is in human language. So we have signs that are read and words that are heard. And of course, illiterate societies are far in advance of oral societies. So maybe I'm pushing the point too far, but I'm going to make the point anyway. I think we begin to see that the valuation is turned over a bit. So again, some people, there were some sources that were shared with me. A divination system is a standardized process derived from a learned system based on an extensive body of knowledge. Sometimes the diviner's body is also an instrument or the vehicle of communication. Again, it's almost an added, sometimes it's also the body, but what's most important in divination is this standardized process. Or Philip Clark, and just recently when we had our conference, gave us this: producing knowledge based on divine spiritual agency, or a more or less esoteric system of reference available only to trained specialists. The first I would take to be prophecy, and the second I would take to be divination using some kind of technique. Or finally, Emily Hearn, knowledge produced by interpersonal transactions with the gods. Once again, whether it's portrayed in a way that you're having some kind of transaction with the deities, whether you understand what they say or not, or an understanding of forces and processes, which seems to be, again, valued a bit more highly. Finally, Vernant, which everyone knows as well. This is an interesting distinction, I think. The ordinary competence of divination, there's no trace of an equivocal or ambiguous answer in the oracle's response. But in the prophetic function, on the other hand, the sign is ambiguous. So we have the unambiguous on one hand, what can be read, and on the other hand, something that's perhaps a little more difficult to decode. So I line these up. Reading over hearing for shepherd. Standardized and disciplined for peak as opposed to bodily possession, which sounds a little frightening, but you know, something else outside is taking control of the body. Clark's system of reference, or divine agency. A Hearn, understanding of processes or interpersonal transaction. Because I'm sensitive to the use of words, I think it's the words that are used here that kind of alerts me that some kind of distinction is being made. And I map that distinction then onto other sorts of bipartite distinctions that we tend to make. For instance, scholarship or, you know, expository prose over poetry. Expository prose is something that needs to be analyzed. Poetry, on the other hand, is a bit more wild and personal. In the modern world, I'm talking about now, because I think the valuation has changed. And I'll show you actually a statement on poetry in just a minute, where you'll see the same sort of shift. Analytical over the emotional, or finally just science and religion. So here's the poetry. Shakespeare. As imagination bodies forth the form of things unknown, the poet's pen turns into shapes and gives to airy nothing a local habitation and a name. That's discovery through imagination. So you can say that these are airy nothings, but they were there somehow. They now have these things unknown are now known. Whereas a modern kind of interpretation from poetry, here's a good example, I hope, from W.H. Auden in his preface to Goethe's Italian Journey. To offer a translation to the public is to claim that one does know how Goethe would have written it had English been his native tongue. To claim, in fact, that one has mediumistic gifts. And as we all know, mediums are often rather shaky characters. So, I'm not making a strong point here. I'm just saying that what I want to study, and that is this kind of prophecy, tends to be given a secondary kind of status in modern society. And we have to look past that to see how prophecy was valued in China. Why? Well, prophecy was the way that auguries were made regarding the mandate of heaven, who held the mandate of heaven, who was fit to rule and who was not fit to rule, what the next political steps should be. Often these were done through, not just through divination, but also through prophets of various sorts, or oracles of various sorts. Then, finally, I want to talk about a passage from Bruno Latour, which I think is very interesting, which tends to show why, if I can make the connection between religion and poetry and prophecy, which I think it seems very clear to me from my Chinese sources, but if I can make that, then there's something else we have to keep in mind, and that is our analytical kind of inattention to what prophets and poets really say, or religious people. Latour is making the point about social scientists, but I think it's a point that should extend to anyone who studies religion, because in religious studies, let's keep Latour's phrasing, nowhere more than in religious study. Did scholars, and I'm going to leave social sciences out for now, did scholars learn A, to deprive of any proper ontological status the entities evoked by those they study? Of course, this God you're talking about doesn't exist. So this is a modern world. I don't care what you have to say about it. B, to ignore the explicit wordings and behavior of those they study. And C, to substitute what is said to be felt and what is not said and not felt by what is not said and not felt, sorry. So in other words, what people say and do is substituted with what they don't say and don't do, something else, some other motivation, economic forces. In China, it's Jinshen Jitua, a spiritual, people who are religious need a spiritual crutch, or scholars employ Marxist explanations, religion is the opiate of the people. And I just learned that this opium, religion is the opium, not of the people. It is the opium that puts social science readily to sleep at the very moment. This is almost a snow clone. The snow clone is a phrase where you can substitute parts of it and still recognize it. So opium is, religion is the opium of the masses becomes religion is the opium of the social scientists. Or ignoring the religious is the opiate of the social science. So I list this because, again, there's a bit of a devaluation going on, not just in a society at large, but by scholars of what we regard as religious and religious studies. And I think if I can, in what follows, pay a little closer attention to what the people I study say, it will improve my scholarship. So that's what I'd like to do. Okay. So this is this Taoism I study is the religion of the Chinese people that began in China with more or less input from Buddhism in, let's say, the second to the fifth century is primarily the period I'm dealing with. And sometimes I deal with the 10th century. We have to cover large swaths of history. You might not know this, you people who do European studies. We tend to have to cover large periods with many more books for some reason. So this period of Taoist history, Taoism was a religion which was learning to build temples and establish a priesthood. It was developing its scriptures, which were not closed scriptures, but open, and was developing various meditation styles, communal liturgical styles, everything that we associate with religion in the West. According to the standard view by Rolf Stein and Peter Nickerson primarily, but other people as well, the Celestial Masters, who started in the second century as the first movement, they were actually trying to form a kingdom, but they had a particular view of how society was supposed to work, and that is that the society was in trouble because people were misbehaving, and that in order for a society to be healthy, it had to have goods and services flowing through it to all parts of society the way that a body needs qi, or breath, or force, or vitality, flowing through it in order to operate. So the model of the body and of the body of society was very strong in Taoism, and the idea was that what kind of sin did people need to confess, particularly the sins of blocking the flow of goods and services by hoarding things for themselves, that sort of thing. So there were also murder, I mean, robbery, the sorts of things we usually associated. So they held the principle that because of these sins, people became ill. The same way the society failed if everyone failed, it didn't participate properly. So they would reject mediumism because they wished to establish the doctrine that misdeeds led directly to disease, and to distinguish themselves from popular religion, which was relied upon wealth and control of the society from the center, right? So they wanted, and this movement to start a kingdom then soon spread throughout China. And as it did so, the standard story, by the 5th and 6th century, it began to adopt a divination against their prior inclinations. The Chinese scholar Ge Zhaoguang, in writing the History of China, History of Thought in China, has accused the Taoism in a book that he calls the surrender of Taoism. And that surrender is for him things that were originally part of the religion that were later modified. This idea that sin or misdeed caused disease was later modified. It's one of the things he lists. But of course, any religion adapts to society. And I also don't think it's quite true that Taoism separated itself so completely from divination. But this is a standard story that we're dealing with. What I would like to give you as an example for how Chinese tended to look at divination, to get back to my original point about how divination and prophecy are literally kind of the same thing, and what it is that makes them similar. I want to look at a story that actually involves a method of divination using chess pieces. The 12 chess pieces were divided into a set of four each, three sets of four each, marked upper, middle, and lower. By tossing these, a trigram was generated. The trigram was matched to a poem in a little booklet, and there are also various commentaries on the poem and on the name of the trigram, which would give you your fortune. So by throwing these 12 chess pieces, the practice seems to have come about around 4th century, as far as we can tell, about the time I'm talking about. And here's one example. Number 321, delivering the goods, initial good fortune. The poem is, it doesn't rhyme in English, so sorry. But it does in Chinese. The guest comes from the south, presenting to me good things, treasures and jewels, a gold bowl and a jade cup. Sounds wonderful. And indeed, all the commentaries say that this is a wonderful prognostication. So, we have one example that I'm aware of this particular trigram being cast by an individual, and that is for Zhang Mi, who died in 483. This is from one of the Chinese histories. So what it basically, to summarize the story, after 482, for some reason, Zhang Mi began turning down all offers to work in the court. He wanted to stay a recluse. Just at this time, a new emperor, the martial emperor, came to power. And once more, Zhang Mi refused to serve. At the time, Wu Di was ill, so Zhang Mi went south, visited one of the princes, a member of the imperial family, and said to him, actually asked him a question, but this is a very provocative sort of question. His Highness is unwell. There are no suitable candidates in the palace. What plan do you have? In other words, do you want to become emperor? I'm here to support you. Do you think you might rise up at this time? Well, the emperor heard about this. He got better. And he heard about it, and he sent Zhang Mi another request that he take a position. At this time, Zhang Mi cast the stones and got a guest is coming south, a gold bowl and a jade cup. And sure enough, the guest from the emperor, meanwhile, the emperor found him guilty because he wasn't showing up for office, sent him a gold cup full of poison. The whole point being that the prognostication was correct, Jiangmi had misread it, or maybe it was still a good omen because Jiangmi, but anyway, the important point and the reason this story is told is because it's a hermeneutical kind of puzzle. It's a question of whether Jiangmi got it right after all. Maybe this was the best that could have happened for Jiangmi, is that he was given death by the emperor rather than have his head actually chopped off. So, all right. So I think with that in mind, what I want to do is give you my three examples now. Fabrizio mentioned it. This is the Zheng Gao, or Declarations of the Perfected, a unique text in Chinese history in that these are the words of a medium who served as a family. The medium's name was Yang Shi, and I'll just call him the medium, so you'll know. And he served a patron who was a minor member of the Jin court of the imperial court at the time, named Xu Mi. And this is in the 360s, early 360s. The work was eventually, all of these fragments were eventually collected by a scholar right around the end of the 5th and beginning of the 6th century, so not too much later, who put them together into a book called The Declarations. We'll also hear about Xu Mi's two sons, the bad son, Xu Lian, and Xu Hui, the good son. So this is the book, The Declarations. What makes this unique is that we know that Taoists operated in families throughout the realm. This is the only record, intimate record, we have of actual communications between people and their medium, letters written back and forth. Xu Mi had an estate very near the southern capital, and so he was not, and sometimes he would be in the capital and the medium would send notices to him, and then he would ask questions of the medium about where are they now type, about local heroes, people who are supposed to have ascended, that sort of thing. So what's interesting to me now is, or what I'll be interested in now, is how prophecy works within this and how it kind of builds, in some cases, on the prestige of divination. This is a prophecy of 22nd January 368, and we're going to see literature, poetry, right? This kind of, and prophecy all seem to go together because it's a poem that is presented by the gods. It's for Xu Mi, how do we know? It's very hard to interpret, actually. Damp and dragging elder, depressed and dejected, though bright within, there's only one bright spot in the whole thing. He has some kind of inner brightness, he's aging. Discard the ties of the past and your form will no longer be as before. So basically what this is, seems to be telling, and again, in translating it, I'm making it probably clearer than it is in the original Chinese. But I'm thinking, given his knowledge of the revelations received by this medium, the patron would have read it in this way. So far, we don't have a prediction. What we have, injunctions. Shake off, purify, refine. This is the nature of obtaining the Tao. Bring spirits and heart into harmony. Raise cloudy noumena to flower forth. So it's important at this point to notice that the Chinese did not believe in a single Cartesian body and soul, but instead of a body made up of various spirits. And the dissolution of those spirits would be death. Keeping the thing together. Many of the Taoist practices actually have this in the title. They are something like meditation on keeping unity, meditation on keeping the spirits from leaving. So you want to keep your bodily forces together. So Basically, we still have no prediction. Finally, we do. Inclined to view the morning, seeing the sound of Ritu fragrant as thoroughwood. Now, reaching the 10th year, Jiwei nominates one. Still not clear. 10th year nomination. In the Taoist context, where the other world was a world of bureaucracy, nomination to a post meant success after death. So there would have been that thought in his head. So who's Jiwei? Everything urges one forward. Do not be less than diligent. It sounds like he has maybe only the 10th year he'll die and take a post in heaven. That would have been his first thought. Whoever Jiwei was, he was going to nominate. Of course, we get this being a medium's communication. The goddesses also give him a interpretation. So that is indeed that he has 10 more years to work on refining his body so he can take a position. What about geomancy? A similar sort of thing. The gods respond. There's a problem with one of the graves by a member of the family. The wife of the patron, the grave is causing trouble somehow, and so they want to rebury her. So this is how it's done. A man appears, Fan Youcheng, who is particularly good at geomancy, and he died at the end of the Wei Dynasty. So nothing better to fix your grave than to get a dead geomancer, who describes the sort of, and I don't go into all the detail here, but he describes how you would put a good tomb together. So this is a sort of what I call a magic echo throughout the text. These are things that normal Chinese would use divination for, but here we're doing it through a medium, so, without any loss of, apparently, in fact, with an augmentation of prestige, because, in fact, this is a wonderful dead geomancer who can tell us that he is now in an underground Taoist study center, the Palace of Youthful Incipients, precisely because he has such a great tomb. So obviously it's a good tomb for you to be buried in. Finally, a dream. And this is a little bit more complex. What I wanted to mention first, before I get into this, is that dreams were real to the Chinese of this period. There's things that happen to various elements of your body which leave during sleep. If you have a bad dream, for instance, the incantation that you use upon waking would command all of your bodily spirits to occupy their positions and keep parts of your body from wandering off again. Because it says something like this: perfect and mysterious grand cavern, extend and refine my three cloud souls. The first cloud soul quickly gathers the seven white souls. The second cloud soul quickly guards my muddy pellet, my brain. The third cloud soul receives my heart and regulates it. Quickly inform the Lord of the Three Primes. I have encountered an unpropitious dream. My seven white souls have roamed. And it goes on and on to talk about how you should keep these spirits in line. But there was also prophecy through dream, and that's what I want to talk about. The medium reported one night that he had a dream that went on and on. He dreamt that he'd spent half a day climbing a great mountain. When he reached the top, he found an enormous palace with 1,000 rooms, and above, vast bodies of water. He looked into the skies and he saw a white dragon, 100 feet long, flying along, just shining and glowing. And then a woman emerged and three times entered the beast's mouth, three times emerged a moment later and then stood facing him. And then a man came to his right, an older man. And he said, the medium looked at the dragon again and said, can the dragon be ridden? And the man said, yes, there are four people who ride it. First of all, he says that the woman who enters the dragon's mouth is called the Jade Maiden of Grand purity,
Shenzhenfu.
And the four people who may ride the dragon are Zhangyan Shi, Shi Qing'an. I told you not too much Chinese, but I didn't promise no Chinese. And Xu Yufu and Ding Wenying. Xu Yufu is the important one here. We don't know who these other people are, so you can forget them. This is the good sign. So the dream is about him. And then the old man has each of the four recite a poem. The poems are given in the dream. They're pretty incredible poems, all from a dream. And he judges the character of each of these four people on the basis of the poem given in the dream. For instance, he says that Shi Qing'an possesses wide-ranging talent and easily advances. Zhang Youshi is harmonious in physical form, but finds it difficult to understand things. He's a good-looking guy, though. And who else do we have here? Ding Weining is secretive and exudes reticence. And we can tell, this actually matches the poem, if you look at the poem. This is a really good way of telling a person's character by poem, which in fact the Chinese did in life. If you remember, by the Tang Dynasty, poetry was used to pick officials, so for the official exams. Finally, the good son, and that's where it's really important, right? Is widely cautious and full of doubts. But I think this dream is meant to convince him that he has something destined. These people all hold a celestial rank. The attendant officer on the Thearch's court, but fortunately it's not an onerous position because you only have to ride the dragon one day out of court. It's actually a kind of a nice job. And then he actually, the old man said, "This the good son, is actually," he says to the diviner, "he's your master, isn't he?" And the master says, no, he's not. So there's like this prediction is redoubled. Finally, the bad son shows up. And the bad son runs up the mountain. And because the old man said, "We left some wine up there for you." He goes up, gets some wine to drink, comes back down. The old man asks him, "How did you like the wine?" He said, "Well, it's a little bitter." And old man says, "Oh, only a country bumpkin would think." So that is, the bad son's not predicted to take a good position in the afterlife. Finally, once this is all over, we get this pronouncement. In fact, that everything that is in the dream actually happened, and the gods come and reaffirm that by saying to the diviner that during the dream your perfected qi moved the spirits within you, and they all sought into the myriad directions. So when his spirits come out of his body, he encounters what's true and real and lasting. Not because he's in control of his spirits. Spirits then came from their mysterious dwellings in the eight directions of space, the spirits in the macrocosm, and your form and your cloud soul soared to meet them. This is a sign of your signal attainments. In other words, only a real medium could possibly do this. These matters make clear what is dark and occluded. This is no fictive construction. Everything may be told to your patron and to the rest. But don't widely disseminate it. This is no small matter. You should be cautious. So, finally, I want to end with just a couple of vignettes. This is actually a very late painting of a Taoist ritual. It seems kind of boring. If you look at it closely, there's not much going on. There's a Qing prince who's presenting. Taoism kind of seems like this from the outside, actually. There's a musical group, and they're all standing in nice file here. The master is conducting as the Qing prince bows. Everybody else is chanting, so there's not much going on. But in fact, there is an important kind of clue, and that is that if you look at the banners, the wind is blowing across the sea. So this is a movement of qi, and this is the first time a Chinese person looking at this. Qi, energy, breath, vitality, moving through this scene. As a matter of fact, this 18th century picture can be equated with a 3rd century text, which talks about what happens when you go out to burn incense to offer to the gods of the 5 directions. You first determine which god is going to descend to you by letting the incense smoke rise up. If it goes straight up, it's the central thearch. If it goes to the east, green, to the south, red. So these are the directions according to the 5 phases. If it swirls, the spirit girl, who's the envoy, who heads the procession of all. And if you watch the flame of the holy light, it'll be expressed through the candles, and this kind of qi of your offering will meet with the qi of the spirits descending. So this is what's important when people are looking, rather as in the example I gave you before of somebody who's actually manipulating chess pieces, cracking, or rather the poem comes through a god descending and giving you something. What the Chinese look for in these kind of scenes and the hermeneutics, the kind of expression is from a tradition of analysis and maybe representation. I suppose you could say that more than analyzing a scene, they're representing it in certain sorts of ways. That the qi moves through scenes and makes things positive and forward-looking. It becomes essence, which is essential concretization of qi. They look for spirit, soul, transcendent, otherworldly signs, what's numinous, what seems to be numinous and heavenly or spiritual in the scene. These words show up again and again and again in portrayals of divinatory results or in analysis of the words of a medium. Because, of course, mediums can be false mediums as well. Although there's not as much, we were talking about Tibetan prophecy and mediumship today. There seems not to be, outside of some early celestial master texts, there seems not to be so much of a talk about how one tells a false medium. What you look for is the force, the patterns for something that's successful, seems to work, seems to match the inner patterns, principles, or essential configurations of the situation. Again, qi, moved by qi, breath, and energy. One final example. And these pictures are just to show China was in, these are from 3rd century BCE, the terracotta warriors, famous terracotta warriors that ring the tomb of Jinshu Huangdi. And what they show is one aspect that a later writer on these issues, and I'm going to talk about this kind of physiognomy, judging people by looking at the qi movements in their face, and which have formed them, even if they keep their expression mild or keep their face expressionless, you should be able to see the qi that fills them and moves them to act in certain sorts of ways. The only surviving book from the 3rd century CE says that people make their faces thick. In other words, they try to hide their true emotions. And this is actually what people are trained to do. Etiquette, Confucian etiquette, ritual. In certain situations, this is the way you act. In certain situations, this is the way you dress. If the mat is not square, you do not sit down. You do not kneel. So how in the world, the problem then is, how in the world do you judge officials? When everybody looks and acts precisely the same. again, it's the it's explained using the language that I've just given you, the language of qi. Even a person who is doubtful about most forms of divination, when it comes to physiognomizing, thinks that one can tell what people are really like by looking at their bones and their joints, examining the patterns of the skin. It's a method of judging what's inside through the configuration of the outside, through how it manifests itself on the outside. Whether or not it's possible, I don't know, but it's the same kind of, you can't help but use, if you write a poem, you can't help but manifest what's in your actual will and intent. That's why the early Confucian discourse on poetry said, Shi Yin Zhi, poetry expresses the will. And that's also the same sort of movement of qi that you can't just kind of keep hidden. So, what I guess my major point is a very simple one, finally, after all of that. My major point is just that prophecy itself is something that goes hand in hand with divination in China as well as in the West often, and that it was not devalued in Chinese society of the time, that it had its place, and that the language used to talk about it, which is what interests me the most because I love poetry, is exactly the same. So thank you all for your attention, and I hope for a lot of good commentary. Thank you.